The thinking that a product company establishes at the core of their strategy really comes down to understanding who it is they're trying to sell to, what is their ideal customer profile, understanding those folks' jobs to be done, and working to fulfill upon the needs of their customers. And in the world of publishing and media, those customers are the audience, right? The consumers of the content, the consumers of the information. And building a product that helps them meet their needs, first by understanding it and then fulfilling upon it and doing that over and over again, again and again, that is where the intention comes from, right? The intention to create something that's a mutually beneficial commercial relationship. Put simply, it's building something people are willing to pay for.
Welcome to the Rebooty Show. I'm Brian Morrissey. Sorry for the spotty posting the last couple of weeks. I have some things in my irony now. We have several good episodes coming up, including one next week with NYU professor Jay Rosen, who I always enjoy talking to about the journalism side of the media business. On this week's episode of the Rebooty Show, I'm joined by Matt Cronin, founding partner of House of Kaizen, which works with publishers and other companies with recurring revenue businesses to align their business goals with audience needs through customer experience frameworks. That's a fancy way of saying that House of Kaizen makes sure that the needs of the audience are not forgotten. Matt and I are doing these quarterly to dig into the question of what it means really to be customer-centric for a publisher and how to put those needs at the center of business strategies under all the litany of pressures that we discuss on this podcast frequently. This seems obvious, but more often than not, the needs of the audience have been placed further down the priority list at many publishers. And I think the challenges the businesses face in some ways are a lagging indicator of that. House of Kaizen's been a great partner of the Rebooting. I really appreciate Matt's support and everyone there. And I love discussing these topics, particularly with Matt, because he sees beyond publishing. And I believe the industry can sometimes be too insular and stuck in the belief that its challenges are completely unique. So hope you enjoy this conversation. As always, please send me your feedback and guest suggestions and any other comments at bmorrissey@therebooting.com. And please leave this podcast a rating and review and comment. I always like to read those. So on to the conversation with Matt. All right, cool. Matt, thanks for joining me. Talk a little bit about, I think, a major issue that is a recurring theme as publishing changes, and that's how to get more customer-centric.
Brian, great to be here. Always happy to talk about that.
So one of the things I just want to start off on, just a couple like news items. One is BuzzFeed recently released their annual report, and it comes with a letter from Jonah Peretti, the CEO. Something that stood out to me. One, you know, BuzzFeed giving up on the idea that platforms are going to quote unquote cultivate a media ecosystem where quality publishers can thrive. It was always sort of betting on this notion that the interests were aligned between publishers and platforms, and that didn't come to fruition. And he included one statistic that I'm trying to wrap my head around. From 2020 to 2023, BuzzFeed's Facebook traffic declined 74%. And you know, they mitigated that with direct traffic growing 12%. Now, I'm not like a math expert, but that's tough. But I think what it speaks to for me is a lot of publishers are waking up to this idea that they need to pivot completely in order to truly understand their audiences. And the reality is a lot of them simply don't. Is that something you see?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, we're oftentimes looking at this through the context of history, where publishers were the platform. I think we've talked about this before. You know, they were in fact the delivery mechanism for all the content, and they were the device. It's what people held in their hands. And they owned so much of that direct interface, which they gave away over the last couple decades to these platforms that understood being closer to the end user, being closer to the human being, is where all the leverage resides, right? So it subordinated publishers created opportunities for publishers like BuzzFeed to sort of capitalize on that relationship, you know, play the game of listicles and headline optimization and those kinds of things that worked well in the platforms. But at the end of the day, the platforms never needed them. The platforms only needed the interfaces with the humans. And so now I think we're left in a scenario where publishers are like, oh no, we no longer have that interface. And the value of shifting the business away from distribution via platforms back to interfaces with human beings is a huge challenge. One that's really hard, I think, for a lot of leaders to wrap their head around and to kind of understand the context or the ways in which that can be done.
Yeah.
It's super exciting in my mind. I think it's a real opportunity, but it's a very, very interesting time.
Yeah. You're going to do the challenges, the opportunities thing on me, aren't you?
I have to.
We all have roles to play. That's good. No, that's a great point. And because I think a lot of the playbooks and a lot of the infrastructure and a lot of the processes that were built up around something completely different. And that's a sort of fundamental first principles kind of thing. And changing that on the fly is really difficult. You know, BuzzFeed itself is now presenting itself as an AI sort of tech enabled company, which I don't know. I'm hoping to have Jonah on this podcast in a few weeks to discuss this. I like Jonah, and I give BuzzFeed a ton of credit for a lot of format innovation that they've brought. And it's going to be fascinating to see if they can, you know, turn this around and become a different type of company. You know, but I think when I look around, and I wish it wasn't the case, I really do, I see a lot of major publishers floundering in this transition, this very fundamental transition to being audience-centric. It came up with Forbes just the past couple of weeks. Forbes was operating a subdomain that was not made for people. It was taking the articles on the regular Forbes site, which are, I would say it's an aggressive UX, if I could be euphemistic. Troy Young on a fellow podcast praises it for its ad density. It depends on what floats your boat. But anyway, they created a subdomain that they were using, Taboola and Outbrain content rec networks, in order to funnel traffic there. And it's a classic arbitrage game.
Mm-hmm.
I wrote about it. It was funny for me to read about this, you know, quote unquote, expose in the Wall Street Journal, because I wrote about Cafe Mom doing literally the exact same thing. This was 2013.
Yeah.
Like these tricks, these arbs are, you know, sometimes they change, but like sometimes they're just the same things again and again. And basically what they were doing was taking the content and, you know, remaking it into slideshows, and you get mm-hmm. like 154 ad exposures for a 600 word article if you go all through that. And they buy the traffic with titillating headline, I'm sure, and in the content rec networks. I don't hate the player. I do sort of resent the game sometimes. I think with those kinds of things, I truly believe we'll end up seeing the utility of that decline. And I understand in the short term, a lot of publishers feel as though they need to be doing these kinds of things, but it's hard for me to see how, I mean, arbitrage by its definition, its function is short term. It should close.
Right. Yeah, that's a really interesting dynamic. I think we see a lot of these sort of hacks, as you've pointed out, happening in the shadows, in the environments in which the demonstration of what works and what doesn't work is only apparent in a spreadsheet, right? It's only something that you can see and understand in a way that's disconnected from the human experience. And because of that, it's a lot easier to do. I think it's just easier to kind of like turn the dials, flip the switches, and manufacture something that looks good in a context that's somewhat undefined without actually taking a step back and thinking about it through the eyes of a human being and through their context and through their experience and what it is that they are looking to achieve through your product. That's a much more complicated way of organizing your business strategy. One that I think honestly puts a lot of fear in the minds of many publishing leaders. Unfortunately, the fear of embracing that kind of change seems to be stronger than the fear of watching the business decline. But, you know, there is a real potential to look at this from a different point of view and to recognize that the spreadsheets aren't telling the whole story. That in fact, there is the human point of view that can drive a more sustainable, more healthy business.
Yeah. Yeah, they might just not want the feedback, to be honest with you. I mean, anyone is like, you know, have you ever done one of those 360 reviews? It's like, oh, wait, I like the reviews for the other people.
Absolutely. Yeah, it's hard to make sense of, you know, what humans are expressing and experiencing, for sure. People are complicated, without a doubt. And so for publishers to embrace the idea that their audiences are made up of many different groups of people versus one homogenous group, each of those groups has their own complexities and their own differences. It just makes things harder to do. And I think it's a real challenge to look at how a business can evolve and adapt in order to serve those complexities than it is to look at just manufacturing MFA type of sites that affect a spreadsheet that look good to advertisers. And I will also say that the advertisers have a role and a responsibility in this as well, right? Like, advertisers need to get closer to their publishing partners in order to foster and cultivate a higher quality audience.
Yeah.
If they're going to be buying that audience, then they have to make an investment in the publishers to help do that. I think that's really important.
Yes. But again, I want this to be true. I really do. At the same time, you know, like, there's a bunch of marketers who will be coming to Miami next week for this giant event possible in Miami Beach at the Fontainebleau. Mm-hmm. And a whole circus will arrive because, you know, once where the marketers go, there's like an entire circus around it of like ad tech, tech. Like, everyone is nipping at the heels of the marketing people, which is mm-hmm. kind of ironic because marketers are kind of disempowered within the organization. But then when they, you know, I understand why they go to a lot of events, because at the events, they're like, you know, royalty.
Exactly.
Meanwhile, like, yeah. they go back to the office and they've got the CFO being like, this is nonsense. So it's a push and pull.
This is true.
But yeah, look, marketers pour money into these MFAs, all right? And then they act shocked. And the reality is they've set up all the incentives with their agencies, with their ad networks, et cetera, to look good on spreadsheets. And MFAs can look good on spreadsheets. And so it's turning a blind eye. It's not caring. It's mm-hmm. it performs. And I think that the pivot to performance has led to a lot of these things that I'm sure a lot of marketers will be on stage, you know, saying how terrible it is. And I'm kind of reminded, I'm like, but you're like, literally just about the only people who can change that, because you control the money that goes into the system. And that is, people respond to incentives, and money is the number one incentive in any economic system. So kind of, it's up to you to fix it. Like, and I just see them dodging it, because when you have the money, you don't have to be accountable. You know, I mean, mm-hmm. you have to be accountable to your bosses, but they don't have to be accountable to building a sustainable media ecosystem. So I want it to sort of change, but I also believe in incentives. And until they're in the incentives, I'm not sure it will. But on the publishing side, I think the incentives are absolutely shifting, whether publishers like it or not, to, I guess, what you would call intentional audiences. I've heard controllable, which I think intentional is better, to be honest with you. And this is basically, at least the way I understand it, the era of quote-unquote traffic is clearly over. And a lot of that was just fly-by-night audiences that arrived through search or through social. This traffic, leave search aside, social traffic was always crap. Like, it was bad traffic. Maybe other people mm-hmm. saw different things. I saw in our analytics that, like, the social traffic was the worst traffic. People would arrive from Facebook and spend like 14 seconds there because we had written some, you know, brand fail social media post. These people didn't convert into newsletter subscribers, but they looked good on some spreadsheet because we said, oh, we have like a million like visitors a month. Meanwhile, like, our addressable market is not that big, but leave that aside. So explain to me what this like shift to intentional audiences means.
Yeah, it's a matter of really understanding audiences more like consumers of a product, right? The thinking that a product company establishes at the core of their strategy really comes down to understanding who it is they're trying to sell to, what is their ideal customer profile, understanding those folks' jobs to be done, and working to fulfill upon the needs of their customers. And in the world of publishing and media, those customers are the audience, right? The consumers of the content, the consumers of the information. And building a product that helps them meet their needs, first by understanding it and then fulfilling upon it and doing that over and over again, again and again, that is where the intention comes from, right? The intention to create something that's a mutually beneficial commercial relationship. Put simply, it's building something people are willing to pay for. And at the core of that is also a matter of, in the media space, recognizing that the consumer is ultimately the customer, right? It's not the advertiser necessarily, because all of the things that the advertiser has valued for many, many years, as you just pointed out, they're disappearing. The volume and the scale of it all is disappearing. So now it's really necessary to recognize that what isn't going away are the people who truly want the product, the people who truly use and value the product, and embracing them, building for them and approaching them in such a way that you can foster and grow that audience, that intentional base of people, is really where I think the sustainability in this space is going to come from. It may be at smaller scale, but it'll be more valuable. And, you know, to your point earlier about, you know, valuing something for its ad density, you know, advertising will never go away. It has to exist in this space for sure, but we need to value it more for its contribution and its yield, less so its density and less so its impression count, right? So creating those sort of environments where the intentional audience is more valuable because they purchase the product, because it helps them solve a problem, and we can advertise to them in such a way that the advertising enhances that experience. It actually does create something more valuable for the end user at the end of the day. And that might sound like a crazy concept to a lot of people, but truthfully, you look back in the history of media, and people did enjoy advertising in certain publications, right? It was a part of the consumption experience to understand who was advertising there and to you know, that's part of what made advertising such a glamorous business. It was an enjoyable thing. We've definitely moved away from that. But I do think that there's the potential with looking at intentional audiences and building for the human experience, we can come back to that edge.
I'm going to date myself, but in college, like people had like the absolute ads from the back covers of magazines, like up on their walls.
Yeah,
maybe this
exactly.
Is just Providence College, but they did.
Yeah. Well, it might have been Corona in other places, you know.
But yeah, I mean, you know, nobody's doing that with the retargeting display ads. I mean, I always say like performance marketing ate media, at least on the internet, and that has benefited, you know, those who have the most data and are most, you know, I covered direct marketing for a while. I understand how it works and what the tech platforms are doing is direct marketing for the most part. They've just rebranded it as performance marketing in order to, I guess, attract people to the field who wouldn't normally go into direct mail. But I'm like, what you're doing is not all that different, to be honest with you. And publishers have always, you know, most publishers have found their comfort level higher up the funnel in brand advertising. And it's squishier and it's about purpose and making people feel things. And, you know, the reality is within organizations, the CFO loves direct marketing because they love to put a dollar in and get $3 out. And that, you know, that expectation is there. And so for publishers with ad businesses, they got to figure out how they can perform and how they can look just as good on a spreadsheet, because there's a lot of options out there. There's a reason that retail media is exploding, and that is not just taking shelf taker like money. You know, that's the money, the end caps and all the weird in-store marketing. I didn't delve too much into that, but sometimes I would stray into that world, but it had an entirely different jargon.
Yeah, it is an interesting dynamic. I think you're absolutely right that there's, you know, this retail media space is where the budgets are going to begin to flow to a much greater degree. And the CFO, I think, will see that media investments of the past are not yielding the same sort of volumes that they were before, at least in the media space, right? So purchasing media that appears in typical open web media environments is going to lose its scale. Yeah. So that money needs to go somewhere, or goes back into the business. Retail media is, I think, where it will likely head because of this performance heritage that everybody's kind of coming from, this idea that we need to get a certain, you know, ROI that's very directly measurable, and retail media can meet that. I'm hopeful, though, that there is an element of this return to the squishy side of things, this understanding of the brand value. And I do see that time prior to the performance marketing in the digital space, you know, prior to this becoming kind of the dominant perspective on things, I do see that time in which advertisers were investing in the publications that they're working in, right? Mm-hmm. I think they knew that the prices they were paying to reach those audiences were probably inflated, but the value is still there because there was so much more going on around it. And it was hard to necessarily connect one for one dollars invested versus dollars returned. I'm not suggesting that we go all the way back to that dynamic, but I do think that the pendulum can swing back in that direction in such a way that we can value some more squishy metrics that are not just ROI, you know, things that can contribute to ROI through the contribution of branding and familiarity, frequency, those kinds of tactics that media was often used for, not just the direct sale, right? So looking at things like attention metrics and valuing media based upon its ability to deliver attention, I think will hopefully move us closer to that era where we weren't so totally focused on ROI. Yeah. And, you know, I admit I was fully a part of that. You know, I started my career in digital advertising at iTraffic, you know, first digital agency. We push hard in performance marketing. The heritage of House of Kaizen is very much performance marketing, but we've evolved ourselves into really embracing more of that human experience, embracing more of the qualitative data, because we're finding in the work that we do day to day that there are much bigger gains to be had by understanding the human experience and adapting to the human experience versus just the minute optimizations that occur within the spreadsheets. You know, at the end of the day, spreadsheet optimizations find relatively small gains, and that's okay. You know, a small gain every day adds up, and there's a ton of value in that. But you also have to look at shaking things up every once in a while and doing something that's much more innovative and much more dramatic. And those kinds of efforts come from investments that are less directly tied to a one-for-one ROI or a three-to-one ROI, whatever it is.
Yeah, well, AI is going to come and shake things up. I don't know if it is completely yet. There's so many different challenges that have popped up on the publisher side that are not related to AI. But AI is clearly, you know, I think a lot of the focus is on search, right? And look, I get it. If 60% of your traffic comes through search, you got to focus on that. I just see the publications that are being started are not, for the most part, focused on an SEO strategy. Yeah, you got to do that, and you don't have control over distribution. You can get some kind of control over it, but you're never going to have. You're always going to be at the mercy, to some degree, of some distribution choke point. But I think the question ends up being how can publishers adopt AI in a way that builds more sustainable businesses rather than constantly trying to play defense.
Yeah. You know, I was having a great conversation with somebody recently about AI, and it's the fairly aggressive adoption that we're seeing in newsrooms and how it's really, quite frankly, I think just the opposite of the way in which publishers should be looking at embracing AI. Again, coming at it from an org-centric point of view, I think if instead of looking at how AI can be used to produce things faster and cheaper than humans do and in a way to replace potentially humans, we should be looking at how AI can improve the experience for the consumer. How can AI be used to create more value for the consumer so that it actually inspires the organization, inspires the media company, or even the newsroom itself to create sort of superhuman product experiences or content experiences, something that starts with that human being but is made even better because of the application of AI. And it's only through looking at the consumer's experience, the users, and what it is that they value, what it is they're asking for from an AI-empowered experience, that you can get there, right? Very few organizations are actually talking to their consumers and saying, how do you want AI to improve your experience with our product? How much more are you willing to pay? How much more time are you willing to spend if this product were enhanced with an AI component? That, I think, is a real missed opportunity so far. And not everybody's missing it. we're working with a couple publishers that are approaching it from that perspective. And the level of insight that we're getting by understanding the consumer's behaviors relative to their interactions with AI, what they're feeling about it and how they're using it, is really informing mm-hmm. the potential future development of the product. But it's coming at it from the opposite direction of what we typically see news organizations and media organizations doing.
Yeah. So what are you seeing that can, because I find it both a very attractive topic and a very challenging topic. And it's attractive because it's like, there's so many unknowns. You can go in like a million different directions and it changes mm-hmm. so fast that nobody's going to hold you accountable. I like that. But it's challenging because it's so theoretical to some degree at this level. I don't see the application of AI in ways that aren't just either like marketing speak. It's like, yes, we use AI. Like, I mean, yes, okay. Every single vendor out there, all of a sudden, yeah, you use AI. I'm with you on creating better experiences and not just looking at it as yet another efficiency driver. Because the way I've been seeing it implemented is like the way like a private equity firm would. No offense to the private mm-hmm. equity firms out in my audience. I love you all. But if you just use this as yet another efficiency tool, I don't think it's not going to put a dent in creating a more sustainable media ecosystem. So what specifically do you see publishers being able to do? I understand it when you have unique data sets, right? If you have a unique data sets, you can use AI in order to produce some pretty interesting and valuable experiences and insights for your audiences. But what are some other ways? Because I don't think we know yet, for instance, like AI chat. Like, I don't know if chatbots are going to be the way that we interface with these things. I still find it clunky and weird.
Yeah. Well, you're right. It does start with, you know, what's unique about the content or the information that you have to offer. Because, you know, otherwise, Gemini and ChatGPT and Perplexity have already swallowed up and are regurgitating everything else, right? Mm-hmm. And people are beginning to build habits around going to those environments for rather generic content.
Yeah.
So the race for producing
it's great content, for mediocre stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
And look, yeah, exactly. I don't mean that as like a total knock because, like 80%+ of the stuff out there is mediocre. And mm-hmm. even those of us who think we're creating like unique differentiated stuff, a lot of our stuff is mediocre. So it's going to be... Trust me, I'm not like saying this as you know, in celebration.
Yeah, exactly. Well, and that's the nature of generative AI, right? It gravitates towards the means and the averages. Yeah. So by default, it's better than half of everything that's out there, but it's not as good as half of what's out there as well. And I think that's an important consideration for content producers who truly have something that's unique and a valuable point of view that they're bringing to the table that no one else is, in using generative AI to capitalize on that full library of that perspective. There's so many ways that we don't yet know, but we do need to experiment around enhancing the experience of consuming that unique point of view, consuming that niche perspective, whatever it might be. And I would agree, chatbots are not the ultimate manifestation of this interface. It's the first kind of approach to this. Keeping in mind that we're all coming at this from the perspective of our search experiences, but I don't think that search experiences are necessarily going to drive AI interfaces forever. I think it's the way people are looking at AI interfaces now. It's just the next manifestation of search, but we won't just be asking questions of AI. It'll be serving us much more proactively in the future, and it'll be giving us more perspective on the information that we're seeking rather than maybe drilling in so deep, or maybe it's doing both. We don't yet know, but I do think that to your point, it has to start with the most valuable and unique content environments and presenting experiments around how people can engage with something that's valuable in that way, in such a way that it makes it even more valuable, right? It makes it something that the consumer sees as unique and different that they're getting only here, and therefore they'd be willing to either pay for it more or they'd be willing to engage in it much more frequently. You know, one of the things that we're seeing with the publishers that we're working with as we study how their audiences are using their AI interfaces, we're seeing a couple interesting things. One is that people aren't necessarily engaging with it as much as we thought they would, right? So there's a lot of hype around this technology for those of us who are in the business and in the industry, but generally amongst consumers, it's not such a big deal, right? They're more, you know, slower to adopt these things. So the realism
around Neil Vogel at Dotdash Meredith is telling me he's like the proportion of Bing search has actually gone down with AI, not up.
Right.
And I think I was at a dinner and actually a private equity executive. he told me, he's one of the good guys though, not like the other private equity guys. He was like, I hear you on all this like AI stuff. He's like, do you know how long this stuff takes? And he was like, AOL is still $400 million in EBITDA a year business. He's like, people's habits don't change overnight. I'm like, good point.
Yeah, I think there is an element of those of us who are kind of at the tip of the spear of all of this, recognizing that there's a whole lot of change that's going to follow the perspectives that we're developing, without a doubt. At the same time, this specific technology is changing things faster than any prior iteration in the media space, any prior technology innovation or iteration of whatever else we've seen in the media space. And we have watched time and time again, as people have had that conversation with like, oh, the internet's not really a thing. Who's going to consume a newspaper article on their telephone? So we are the ones who are responsible for sort of shepherding the masses into an environment that is ideally better than the one they're in right now. We have to experiment. We have to test it all out. We have to recognize that it may not move as fast as we want it to, but it will probably move faster than most of the other people expect it to. And so there's, I think, this recognition that when we do the research and we find that people aren't using it as much as we maybe assumed that they did, that's one thing. But the other thing is recognizing what effect it has on the things that they're using it for. It is actually increasing engagement. It is actually making people feel like they're getting more value out of it when done in certain ways. So I think there's a lot in this sort of, like we're talking about this before, this complex, sort of messy environment of understanding how human beings interact with things and how they extract value from those things. There is so much potential in this specific moment to really understand that and to build around it by testing and learning and adapting very, very quickly. So that's what makes me excited. I do think that there is a ton of potential in that. For those publishers that are willing to experiment and make those investments, who see themselves with a long-term future, I think there's a ton of potential here in this very moment. The short-sighted folks, unfortunately, I think are going to try and squeeze as much as they can out of this, you know, this current traffic decline, and I think you're going to end up missing the boat, quite frankly.
Yeah, I don't know if you saw this, but Jim Vandehei, who I've always found to be a very perceptive both thinker and doer in this space. And also, he doesn't hide behind like euphemisms, which I really appreciate. He had come out, they're changing a few things up at Axios. But one of the things that he was saying in this Times article is that we're in the middle of a very fundamental shift in how people relate to news and content. And it's going to be as profound, if not more profound, than moving from print to digital. Fast forward 5 to 10 years from now, and we're living in this AI-dominated virtual world. Who are the couple of players in the media space offering smart, sane content who are thriving, and damn well better be us? And, you know, I think when you unpack what they're doing in response to that, a lot of it is leaning into things like events. You know, Jim said that like events grew 60% year over year in 2023, introducing really high-priced membership programs around individuals. I think that is an opportunity that certainly exists out there, because I think when AI is it's going to be a great commoditizer. And if you're producing commodity content, it is by definition mediocre, it's designed to be mediocre, right? And a lot of the internet economy and the internet publishing economy has thrived on that kind of content. Evergreen content is usually fairly mediocre. It is also extremely profitable. You pay to create once and you keep extracting value. Maybe you update it a little bit. Mm-hmm. News content or like, you know, a really creative feature or something, you know, the value plummets. It was never that high to begin with. So if anyone's wondering why there's so much commerce guides out there, I mean, it's just the math. Blame math. Mm-hmm. But the human element is definitely part of it. I harp on this a lot. The part that I wonder about is how larger companies can pull that off. You know, like the platforms, they want a mass of quote unquote creators, of individuals, right? you have a lot of leverage. I mean, I know this with what I'm doing. You know, I have a lot of people help me out, but you know, being able to stay super lean and nimble is like a tremendous leverage in the marketplace versus having all of those fixed costs of people on staff. And I wonder how institutional companies will make that leap.
Yeah, it's a great question. I think it's a really great question. And I, first of all, I just want to say that the idea of blaming math for all of this is fantastic.
Yeah,
I'm going to use that again and again. I love it. Yeah,
you've got a yes and hat on. I'm going to have a blame math hat on the next one.
Please do.
Because anyone says, oh, this sucks, it's like, well, blame math.
Blame math, absolutely. Yeah, no, math has obscured the human connection. And the other thing that Vanderhei said was that it is about digging into the human connection, right? Whether that's in events or whether that's through the digital products, right? But putting that human connection at the core is a really important tenet to the strategy that he just laid out. And I don't think that we can overlook that. So events, yes, they are harder to scale than any sort of digital experience. But the question is, how can you build in what's valuable in events in a larger scale digital environment? I do think it's possible. I often think about the fact that these platforms that news media or media in general are increasingly seeing now as the enemy, whereas previously they were the ally, right? These platforms did something that news media had the opportunity to do, right? It had the opportunity to communicate with masses in such a way that it feels more individualistic, it feels more authentic. You know, these platforms allowed individuals to create content and distribute that content in such a way that it almost feels like people are speaking directly to you, though that message and that experience is being delivered to hundreds of millions of people, right? Media companies continue to operate in a format in which they delivered their experiences and their messages in such a way that it was always meant to be like a one-to-many. It was perceived as less authentic, as social media is, perceived as less connective and requiring a lot more of investment versus just like a brief sort of interaction. And the question is, how has that expectation of what these experiences are like in social media perceived to be more human, right? How can that be brought into these more traditional media experiences? Axios kind of did this, right? When they were the first to introduce their shorter format content, they kind of adopted a lot of these principles that we were just talking about, and they brought it into the news space. I see this as an extension of that. How are they going to adapt further into meeting the consumer's expectations for what a truly authentic and human interaction is by just simply changing and optimizing that sort of interface experience?
Yeah, I mean, you actually make a great point. I used to poke fun at the Axios format innovation being bullet points. But I think the more profound thing is they took the audience's viewpoint. A lot of the B material and throat clearing in the typical news story, and Jim got this like immediately. It was like, most of this stuff is not new or pertinent. Nobody gives a shit. It's just, it's being done to fill column inches, they would say at the time, but also because, you know, the writers want to write whatever. And so they came up with a very concise format, smart brevity, R in a circle. And to me, it's very audience centric because when I read it as a, you know, as someone in this field, I'm like, oh God, this gets so dull and repetitive. Yes, but I'm like, okay, you're just shoving this stuff in the format. But the reality is it is a scalable way to give people what they need as quickly as possible. That is that's catering to the audience at the end of the day.
Exactly. Yeah. You know, I think the standard rules, and I revere journalism. I have a ton of respect for journalists. My perception of the craft is that it hasn't changed to the degree that it could have, that there is a desire to preserve the quality of the craft of journalism, which is incredibly important. But I think what Axios did really well is they adapted it in such a way that it met the needs of the audience better than something that hasn't changed for so many years. I think they're more willing to still stand on what it is that makes quality journalism while also shedding the elements of it that are no longer necessary, that just don't work in the context of the world in which we live in today, where people want a lot more information, a lot more quickly, and get to the point, you know, lead with the lead and then move on. And so, yeah, I think that's the key there, is that they seem to understand, and I love what they're doing. They seem to understand that there is real value in adapting to the expectations of the audience. That's being intentional in my mind. The other thing that they're doing, which is fantastic, is they're leaning into subscriptions even more. So we've heard a lot recently about how some folks are moving away from subscription or believing that subscriptions are no longer the future. And while I wouldn't ever argue that subscriptions are the only way, it does require a balanced portfolio of revenue sources for media companies to be sustainable. I do love this example of Axios leaning further into subscriptions as their way into the future. I think, again, it just leads to this idea of building more intentional audiences and building products that people are willing to pay for.
Yeah. I mean, to me, subscriptions are, I don't know, like a consequence, but they're a consequence of being audience-centric, right? So if you reorient yourself around an audience and be like, okay, we're going to be audience-centric, audience-first, however you want to describe it, that leads to subscriptions, but it can also lead to a different, like, direct sold business. It can lead to commerce. It can lead to events. There's lots of different ways that manifests itself. Subscriptions is just one aspect of it. And I feel a lot of times people were saying, okay, we're going to add a subscriptions element, but it's like, no, that's a consequence of being audience centric. You know what I mean?
Yeah. I think when you start with
You can be audience-centric and not have subscriptions, and you can be subscriptions and not be audience-centric.
Yes, not all rectangles are squares, but all squares are rectangles. Blame math. You know, I think when you start with subscriptions, though, you are inherently more audience-centric. I think that's what you're saying, right? Like, when you start with subscriptions or you lead with subscriptions, you have the ability to be more intentional with your audiences. You know them better. You understand them better. You're collecting more first-party data. But as a result, you're able to better cater to that, you know, what we call in the product world, the product market fit. You're able to better adapt what it is you're providing to the consumers to ensure that they want to continue to buy it and that that value equation exists sustainably. There was this great interview with Jason Fried from 37 Signals recently, where he was talking about the concept of the minimum viable product. And he was saying it's kind of a silly idea, because what we're looking for is not necessarily something that's minimally viable. We're actually looking for something that's minimally buyable. Yeah. We need to create something that people are willing to pay for. And then when you've cracked that nut, you have the opportunity to really build more and more value.
I'm laughing because I used to hear the MVP being thrown around as like an excuse for not spending any money or for something being shitty by design.
Yeah,
it's
exactly.
Like, oh, I've heard, like, this is awful. It's like, oh, it's an MVP. I'm like, oh, okay, then it's fine.
Right. But if we hold ourselves to the standards of creating something people are willing to pay for, it changes everything.
Yeah, for sure. And I guess what I was thinking about is, like, you can have subscription programs and be completely, not completely, but you can be very antagonistic almost to the audience, right? I keep harping on the call to cancel stuff. I mean, don't tell me you're audience centric and then tell me that I have to call between the hours of 9 and 4:30 Central Time in order to cancel a service that I signed up for on the internet. You can clearly process this. This is 2024, yeah? 2024. Mm-hmm. Yeah, you can you can do that. And that's why we've talked a lot about, like, when you get into optimization land, a lot of people end up going into adversarial tactics. Adding more friction absolutely will lower your churn rate. If you require people to show up at your doorstep in order to cancel, you will have fewer cancellations. Mm-hmm. I've sat in those meetings. Everyone has sat in the meetings. Like, can we add a little friction? And, like, yeah, it's very tempting to add friction to. One of the things that came up at one of our dinners, I want to get your take on this because I think it's AI related in some ways, is around dynamic pricing with subscriptions, right? The discussion revolved around whether that was really audience-centric and how it rubbed some people the wrong way. This idea that you're going to be crunching the data and giving different offers to different people. Like, I mean, there's always some aspect of it, but when it gets scaled and when you apply AI to it, you can imagine it. I don't know. What is your take on dynamic pricing as as a strategy, like on an individual level? Because some people say, look, one person's dynamic pricing is another person's price discrimination. I don't know.
Yeah, I think there's two ways to look at this, you know, from opposite perspectives that are equally fair. One is, you know, from a consumer point of view, if I were to find out that the price I'm paying for the exact same product that my buddy is also buying and paying half the price for, I'd feel screwed. I'd feel like that's not fair. And in the consumer world, people generally come at it from that point of view. In the business-to-business world, it's a little bit different, right? I think businesses recognize that they pay different prices for the same product than other businesses do, but people generally pay the same thing for the same product as anyone else might. So,
but not that airline context, tickets. The person sitting next to me is paying a different price than I'm paying.
Yeah, that's a great point. That's a great point. So that gets to the other side of the perspective, which is this concept of value-based pricing. If the person's willing to pay for it, regardless if it's more or less than the other person, then why does it matter, right? If they value the dollar amount that they're exchanging for the product and they're okay with that transaction, then fair game. That's great. There's no problem in that. But I think where the way I look at it with regard to dynamic pricing in the case of media is that I really wonder how significant the gains truly are, to be totally honest with you, right? Because what we're typically talking about in this case is that we're trying to maximize the price paid by the most loyal customers. Again, that sounds kind of dirty, but in truth, the most loyal customers are also generally like a very small segment of these businesses right now, right? So if we're really trying to maximize the value that we get out of this segment, how much are we really contributing to the bottom line? I hear this phrase all the time in this space, but is the juice really worth the squeeze? I think that's the question that needs to be asked about this tactic, because the reality is that it may be much, much more advantageous to, again, be focused on building a product people are willing to pay for, enhancing that experience to the degree that they're willing to pay more and more for that product versus just trying to get a bigger slice of a shrinking pie. Yeah. Let's look at growing the pie overall.
Yeah. Amen. I used to have meetings where everyone's talking about all the kinds of crazy optimizations we could do to squeeze like an extra 2%. I'm like, how about like we stop this meeting, I go and try to help a bunch of other people create better content because that's going to make a bigger difference.
There it is. Yeah. And that to me is just like just another example of how, you know, we all kind of have to recognize that so much of what we try to do to make our businesses better is derived from an organizationally centric point of view, right? It's a hell of a lot easier to apply dynamic pricing to eke out a couple extra cents or dollars from certain customers than it is to rethink the product altogether and to better understand the audiences and their jobs to be done. So we tend to default towards those sort of knob spinning and lever moving tactics that seem to show performance on a spreadsheet versus actually doing the work of understanding the audience, understanding the consumer, understanding their jobs to be done so that we can better meet their needs. Yeah. It feels more complicated and harder, but it's where the bigger gains will come from, especially as we move into this next era.
And just a final point on the audience point, and it's important to understand that it's not like a monolithic audience. There are different segments of the audience that have different needs and they have different jobs that you have to do for them. So, I mean, just a simple thing to me is how do you create products that accomplish those jobs for different segments? And you have to start by understanding those segments and understanding what their needs are and how you can fulfill them. And obviously, you have to have a coherent product. You can't have a trillion different variations on it. But to me, that is a very basic thing that publishers need to start with.
Yeah, I completely agree. You know, and again, looking at the product world for inspiration and examples of how important this is. Earlier today, I learned of this application for the iPhone and for the Apple Watch that's used to track walks when people are pushing strollers. Right. So if you use Apple Fitness at all, it's really interesting to see all the different activities that you can record that your watch is programmed to measure because it, you know, measures your arm swing as you're walking or as you're running. But when people are pushing strollers and their arm is not swinging, it's not tracking their watch, it's not tracking their walks as accurately as it should be. So somebody developed an app specifically designed to track walks while pushing strollers, right? Now, you might think, that's crazy niche. But at the same time, why not think about the fact that Apple thought of almost everything already, but they didn't think of this thing. And it took an understanding of the users and the community to recognize where this gap exists. And anybody who's ever marketed to the parent segment will tell you that this is no small gap, right? This is a huge opportunity.
Yeah. I don't know how defensible the app developers market is going to be, because Apple is going to be like, oh, that's a great idea.
Yeah. Swipe. That looks good.
Appreciate it.
Yeah, no doubt. But I think it's just a really great example of the fact that when you think you know your audience already, there are opportunities lurking in the shadows that should be sussed out. So, you know, we often talk about how it's great to look at dashboards of data. We've all become accustomed to this high velocity quantitative data that we can use to optimize the performance of our businesses. And in looking at that, we've overlooked the fact that the qualitative insights and really understanding consumers' experiences, it just doesn't get the attention that it deserves. And fortunately, we live in a world today where we can gather that human intelligence almost as fast and almost as cheap as the quantitative intelligence that we have. So we should embrace that feedback loop as well. We should make that a part of our thinking, make that a part of our process. In fact, we should lead with that first so that we can begin to find new opportunities to unlock new growth to better serve the needs of our customers through that intelligence. That to me is where we're moving forward. And as things become more automated, more robot driven, that connection to human beings is going to be what's most valuable and most sustainable over the long term.
Amen. Awesome, Matt. Thank you so much. Really appreciate the conversation. I look forward to our future ones.
Likewise. Thanks, Brian.
Cool.